Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Don't try and think for the worst, really, because you're in a small town, you're in a small newspaper, you're covering a story, you know. Stephen's been convicted of murder, he's in jail. Why should somebody want to kill me?
It's not a Bruce Willis film.
No. It was quite scary at times. It made me more determined to think, well, somebody doesn't want me to investigate this case. There's something more to it. Pressure was coming from the police as well to try and drop the thing. You know, think of your family, think of your colleagues and also this sort of thing.
How did your family, how much did they know, I suppose?
Well, I told them as much as they needed to know. I didn't want to tell them the whole rig and roll, but you know, I said, look, if you don't want me to do it, if you know, I'm quite happy, I will drop it and whatever. And Kath was quite adamant, no, if you believe that, you know, Stephen's innocent and there's a chance he didn't do it, etc., you know. And she was sort of questioning herself, well, why are these people threatening then if Stephen's done it? You know, she couldn't understand it. I said, well, neither can I, you know. So she said, well, keep it on, but try and be very protective of the kids. And so, you know, I persevered.
Suddenly it seems like a story worth killing for. Someone's prepared to do that.
Yeah, if somebody bumped me off, that would probably be the end of the investigation.
It's 1995. The campaign to free Stephen Downing is starting to take its toll on Don Hale. It's affecting his health, his work and his family. But despite everything, he's determined to pursue Stephen's cause. The problem was, Don told me, they were entering uncharted territory.
I mean, the interesting thing for me was I was approached with a potential miscarriage of justice on my patch, if you like, on my watch in Bakewell. I never dealt with anything like this before in terms of somebody being innocent of particularly a murder. I never really investigated anything as such, but this was something different. But at the time, I mean, it was very difficult to take a miscarriage case forward because there was no real procedure to do so. As far as the authorities were concerned, and possibly even today in many cases, they think if somebody's been duly arrested, charged and convicted, found guilty by a jury, then that's it. Justice has been done. Now, my problem was, after looking initially at the evidence, to think, OK, well, where do we go from here? If you think I've got a case for presenting that somebody's innocent, where do you go?
In other words, the law in England and Wales at this time was considered infallible. Miscarriages of justice simply couldn't exist. Therefore, there was no way of dealing with them. Which meant there was no way of challenging them. Which meant there was no way of challenging Stephen's conviction.
And you sort of say, well, so when's he going to come out at this stage? And, you rustle the papers and stuff like this. And, well, he's got a review down a... it's well in the future, that. Oh, well, I'm not really sure. You know, it'd probably be about 70, I think, when he's, you know. And this is... You're talking about a man of, what, in his 30s, 40s? Or late 30s, I think he was then. You know, it's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Don decides to get political.
I had to badger, you know, the Home Secretary or the Prime Minister. I had to write to these people directly, get my local MP involved and write to people. You know, I was writing to Maggie Thatcher and different ones to say about this. And I mean, it took a lot of time and effort.
I'm Matthew Paris, a Times columnist. Shortly after Stephen Downing's appeal had failed, I became the Member of Parliament for West Derbyshire.
So can you take us back to that moment when they came into your surgery and describe what happened?
It was, I think, the summer of 1979. I had only for a few months been a Member of Parliament. I was 29 years old. I had no experience at all of politics. And I was holding, I think, my first surgery, MP surgery, in the town hall in Bakewell. And my agent said to me, I've got Stephen Downing's parents to see you. And I knew a little bit already about the case. In they came with an old suitcase and pulled out all Stephen's blood-stained clothing from the day on which he had encountered the body. Well, of course, I'm not a forensic scientist and had no way really of looking at the pattern of the stains on the clothing or knowing anything at all about it. But I agreed to write to the Home Secretary. And from the story they told me, I did feel that the way in which he had been arrested and detained and had confessed was a bit irregular. Unfortunately, the Home Secretary replied to me, he was William Whitelaw, that unless there was new evidence in the case, and in this case there was no new evidence, then according to the law as it then was, the case could not be reopened, the appeal having been turned down.
Patrick McLaughlin, Member of Parliament for Derbyshire Dales.
Where are we today? Where are we sitting?
Oh, right. Well, you've got a magnificent view of the City of London on the corner of Portcullis House. And the other thing that's interesting about Portcullis House is the stone came from Birchover Quarry.
No, in Derbyshire.
In Derbyshire.
I didn't know that.
No.
Wow. I mean, there are a lot of connections. It's funny, isn't it? It's Anyway, so can you tell me what your connection to Bakewell is?
No. Well, I'm a Member of Parliament for, as it was in those days, West Derbyshire. It's now called Derbyshire Dales. When Mr. Downing's father came to see me at a surgery, along with his mother, to make the representations to me about Stephen. I think they'd had attempts before that and sort of drawn a blank and sort of left it, but I do remember them coming to see me, and I've spoken to my predecessor, and he remembers them going to see him at the time.
Matthew Paris.
By 1995, Don had compiled a dossier of evidence which he was convinced cast real doubt on the safety of Stephen's conviction. He persuaded McLaughlin to lend his support to the Downing's campaign.
You know, I remember them sort of, I went up to see them at their house in Moor Hall, which was just around the corner from where Wendy's body was found when she was murdered. You know, it was still, obviously, they were doing all they could to get Stephen released.
Were they carrying around a box of clothes at the time?
They weren't carrying around a box of clothes, but they did show me those clothes. I don't think they brought the clothes to me when they came to see me at the surgery in Bakewell. I think they subsequently showed me those when I went to see them up at their house in Moor Hall.
Don used his contacts in the media to take this new evidence and the campaign to a national and even international audience.
This is from February 95, and this is Don's written this. Derbyshire police are likely to use scientific DNA testing methods to help solve a 22-year-old murder mystery which could prove the innocence of a former Boatwell teenager sentenced for the crime in 1973. Stephen Downing was ordered to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure at Nottingham Crown Court in February 1974 for the murder of the typist Mrs. Wendy Sewell, who was brutally attacked with a pickaxe handle in Bakewell Cemetery. Evidence submitted to Home Secretary Michael Howard last week by West Derbyshire MP Patrick McLaughlin on behalf of his family has now thrown considerable doubt on his conviction. In addition, an anonymous letter containing a host of confidential information known only to a handful of people has also been received and indicates that another person or persons had met with the woman after Downing had left the cemetery. It supports many of the claims made by him at the time, which clearly identifies three other suspects. It has also been confirmed that Downing's fingerprints did not appear on the bloodstained shaft of the pickaxe handle and that there is no obvious connection with the fingernail scrapings of Mrs. Sewell. It would seem that this information was not made available to the defence at his trial. The police are now considering using their modern DNA techniques to compare information on file from 1973 against these new suspects. A further letter received this week and handed to the police gives additional information about known associates of the murdered woman and details of regular meetings with one of the suspects close to the murder scene.
I took it up with the Home Office. We then referred on to the Criminal Review Cases body, which was a new body which had been set up, and getting them to look and investigate it. And I did raise it several times on the floor of the House of Commons as well, in various exchanges with... I think there was one exchange with the then Prime Minister Tony Blair, but he would simply say that it was a matter for the Criminal Cases Review Commission.
Was that the Prime Minister's questions? Because I know it was raised in Prime Minister's questions with Blair.
Yes, it was. I raised it in Prime Minister's questions, and I raised it with the Leader of the House on several occasions as well, about sort of the need to get this moved on a bit.
Don was convinced that the case was going really well.
Of course, I was visiting places like C3 in London, the Home Office. I was talking with the MP, Patrick McLaughlin, and I was thinking, this is, I wouldn't say it's easy, but, you know, if I can put a package together, a submission package together, give this to the police and give this to the Home Office, it's only a matter of maybe a few months or what before he's out. You know, fairly simple. Of course, the law doesn't work like that.
C3 was the criminal case unit of the British government's Home Office. Don told me that it was an antiquated joke, not fit for purpose. And you can read his lengthy thoughts on this organisation and its many failings in his book. In order to get Stephen his day in court and to argue against his conviction for the murder of Wendy Sewell, Don first had to submit his evidence and his arguments to C3. As we've discussed in previous episodes, Don argued that there were problems with Stephen's confession, the confession that formed the main plank of the prosecution's evidence. Problems with the way this confession had been extracted from him and how Stephen was treated by the police, the lack of parents or legal representation, and problems with the forensics. Crucially, Don identified other potential witnesses and suspects who he believed might have had motive and means to want to hurt Wendy. The existence of these Tarantino-esque men, Mr. Red, Blue, Orange, etc., cast real doubt over whether Stephen was the only one who could have had the opportunity to commit this brutal crime. Don didn't need to convict another person, he just needed to establish reasonable doubt.
What I was hoping for was that the C3 would recommend this to go to an appeal, because I'd probably seen him half a dozen times at least. I'd spoken to him on the phone maybe a dozen times. I thought, you know, it was a strong case, strong argument here, really. And I got a letter then out of the blue, and followed by, I think, a telephone call to say, well, thanks very much, but we're packing up. C3s will no longer exist from a couple of months' time. Your case will now be referred to the CCRC, and it's up to them whether they pick up and go with it.
So literally back to square one?
Yeah.
So let's just come back to the CRCC. For people who don't know, can you tell me what that is and how and why it was set up?
It came about as a result of some of the miscarriages of justice which had been taken, been brought to sort of prominence before that. I think it originally came out of the Birmingham pub bombing trial, when a royal commission said that a body like this should be set up, and was set up and then followed through. Before that, it had sort of been a branch of the Home Office, and it would be the Home Office that would decide whether a case should be referred back or not. And then the Criminal Cases Review Commission was brought as a separate body to review cases and to review evidence.
Right, because before that, there wasn't a kind of a structure, was there, for the idea of miscarriages?
It was something which was sort of part of the empire of the Home Office, and, you know, would be made a recommendation to the then Home Secretary. This was a way of trying to sort of continue with the sort of the separation, really, of justice away from politicians.
I suppose it separates an individual case from an attack of the rule of law.
Well, it enables a professional body that's accountable to ensure that these things are properly looked at in an independent way, with no sort of allegations that the Home Secretaries are just trying not to deal with issues.
And it was one of the very first cases, I think it was something like case 97 or something like that, that was came up. It should have been case number one, really, because we were ahead of the game with everybody else. But anyway, it was given to them. I went down. I had about an hour's interview with the officer in charge, who then told me a commissioner had been appointed, Barry Capon, you know.
And a commissioner's responsibility was to look after the case?
Yeah. He was in charge of all the investigation. He would look at what you've submitted, go through everything. If there was a need to investigate, he would send out police officers to carry out further inquiries, statements or whatever. They would look at all sorts of evidence. Don't call us, we'll call you type thing. And we did go over an awful lot of ground, but certain things where he says it was not part of his remit, he would then bombard you with questions and demanding evidence to ask that it was part of his remit in terms of other people being responsible. And it put me in the position of almost playing a detective, you know, as a DI on the case, which was never my intention. I was really looking at, in this case with Stephen Downing, to say, here is, in my opinion, sufficient evidence to cast doubt on the conviction.
Can you pick up the ball as the police and reinvestigate?
Yeah, not necessarily to say, right, you can prove that Joe Bloggs did it or somebody else was responsible for it. But there were a lot of overlaps to say that, not only as I believe Stephen didn't do it, but he's got an alibi at the time of the actual time of the murder. I think you've got the time of the murder wrong. I think she was still alive at that time that you say she'd been attacked and was badly injured. And so I'd got other witness statements which contradicted the original police evidence.
Stephen was also what is termed an IDOM, in denial of murder. This is a complex Catch-22 legal term, which effectively means that unless a convict admits guilt and takes responsibility for a crime, they can't be considered for parole. If you, like Stephen, continue to claim to be innocent and claim and claim and claim again, you're in denial. And you'll remain in prison and your case won't be reviewed until you admit that you did it. It's a fair cop. Or not.
And one of the reasons why he was being kept in prison was because he wouldn't admit to his guilt. So actually, the very fact that he was protesting his innocence and continuing to possess his innocence meant that he was sort of kept in jail. Stephen would have been released before if he'd admitted his guilt.
At this point, Stephen had been in prison for over 20 years, and if he hadn't been in denial, he could have been free after 10, in 1984. 1984, the year that saw the start of the miners' strike, which devastated so much of the industry in Derbyshire and beyond. It was the year that controversial runner Zola Budd crashed out of the Olympics in bare feet. And perhaps most relevantly for Stephen, it was the year Sir Alec Jeffreys announced the discovery of DNA fingerprinting.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A brutal murder, a wrongful conviction, a 27-year fight for justice. Read the full story that inspired this podcast. In Murder in the Graveyard, investigative journalist Don Hale tells the story of his relentless fight to overturn the longest miscarriage of justice the UK has ever seen. Delve deeper into the case that shocked the nation. Murder in the Graveyard. Available now in paperback, ebook, and audio narrated by author Don Hale himself.
Right, the Home Office and the police have both admitted that they are carefully sifting through new evidence. The Home Office has said Downing's case will be considered for the Parole Board review in March. Presently, Downing has served 22 years in jail for a crime he has always claimed he did not commit, and from his cell at Dorchester Prison praised the investigative campaign launched by the Matlock Mercury and supported this week by both Central Television and the Daily Star. "I am innocent," he told the Mercury. "I always said the truth will come out one day, but can't really understand why it has taken 22 years for the police to look at some obvious clues to find the real murderer."
Following on from the first story in the Mercury, Stephen writes again in February, "It really is amazing the power the press has on people. My case officer spoke to me today. He said he'd seen the video 5 times and it was of the view that I'm innocent. It's nice to know that you've got some staff who believe it, even if it's taken some time to get there. I would never have thought for a minute that one of the 4 suspects would have come forward to tender evidence, perhaps even against his own friends. I find it equally hard to believe that the police have allowed vital evidence to remain in a vault for almost 22 years. It seems that they were desperate to secure a conviction, and a fast one, with little regard to who shouldered the blame. It's often been said that the truth will always prevail, and it now looks as if I'm on that path." Then he goes on about the stuff we put in the Daily Star with a contact of mine. He says, "Once until the Daily Star took up my plight in a bid to establish my innocence, I began to have reservations about the kind of reception I would get from fellow inmates. Any fears I had can certainly be laid to rest. This has become big news, and a buzz of excitement ripples through the Wingate Mail Call, with a number of eager lads jostling to the next in line to read the following instalment in what has become Dorchester Prison's very own soap opera."
Stephen's down in prison soap opera.
And again, it shows how it's changed by having publicity, because even the staff here are now wishing me well in the fight to have the Home Secretary exercise a royal prerogative of mercy. Now, that was a rule that was in at the time.
So what was that?
Where they could say that he's actually served over his time, not saying he's innocent,
yeah,
but he's served over his time, he's over his tariff, and that they consider him safe to be released. So, but the Queen would have had to endorse that. It would have had to gone to her, because he was being detained at Her Majesty's pleasure. So the Queen would have had to step in and say, "Well, I think he has served long enough." I think he should be considered for release. So that was, again, where it was done. And this, Michael Howard was involved then as the Home Secretary. It says, the wealth of evidence contained in the dossier would appear to offer the Home Secretary little choice in what action he can take. Whether or not Mr. Howard will view this as a case of Hobson's choice remains to be seen. So he's a bit naive in a sense, thinking, well, because we've got a big splash in the newspapers and the Daily Star and other nationals are beginning to sort of take a shine to this, and I put the submission in, that it's going to be a piece of cake. So you get this sort of misconception that from one minute you're down in the dumps, nobody's going to bother, nobody cares about me type thing, you're pretty down and depressed, to now thinking, well, actually, I may be mistaken. We've got now some publicity in the papers and the national newspapers. We've got the submission gone in. We've got a reaction now back from them, which you wouldn't have got maybe 6 months before. If I'd contacted them, or Stephen's father had contacted him 6 months before, you wouldn't have got that response anyway, you see. And so he's right in a sense, the power of the press was important to spark this off. And so it got everybody talking about it, not just in the community, but, you know, at the Home Office and various other people. And I was called the fly in the ointment, you see, you know. The police called me the madman of Matlock for trying to battle through on this thing.
Don spotted the possibilities of fake news way back before it was even a thing.
Stephen talks about, I would have never thought for 1 minute that one of the four suspects would have come forward to tender evidence. Mm.
The suspect, this was Sid Osnam, who was mentioned in my original documents and whatever. And his statements to me, and I believe he spoke to the police, you know, at one stage, he was identified by probably 8 or 9 different witnesses as being on or near the murder scene at the time of the murder. Parked in his van at the back of the cemetery. And he forever denied it to me. I must have interviewed him several times, and it was always the same thing. I was miles away that day, you know. He couldn't remember anything about it. And yet, it was such an important day, he couldn't remember the day. But he could remember that he was miles away. So it was an odd sort of anomaly. Mm. If you can't remember the day, how do you know you weren't there, or you were miles away? And so it was always, no, I was definitely miles away. But he couldn't remember the actual day or anything about it. But when you put things to him, he still denied it. It was only after I'd gone public with my story in the Mercury, and my colleague at the Daily Star for this, and he put a description of four people, A, B, C and D, of people that were interesting in terms of the initial findings.
Oh, persons of interest.
Persons of interest. And we didn't obviously name them. We just said suspect A, B, C and D and things like that. And he recognised himself as one of these suspects.
Sid Ilsenham did.
Yeah. Because we were saying that the advance now of forensic science, DNA, could now identify him, because we were saying that there was a third blood sample found on the murder weapon, as hairs and fibres, etc., which weren't Downing's, and they weren't the victim. So who were they? As soon as he saw this one, he phoned up saying, you know, I think that's me that's in the Daily Star, you know. He then admitted to me, yes, that was me. And that's why I'm phoning, because I'm worried I could get roped into this murder, you see. But it wasn't me, I didn't do it, and all this sort of stuff.
And you've got a recording of that.
Yeah, I've got some of it. I did the second record, I think. Yeah, I didn't record the first one.
We can't play that because it was recorded for your own personal use. So it's But the press publicity that you put on this.
Yeah.
Did you? Because I know that DNA started. Well, DNA analysis became possible in the mid 80s.
Yeah.
But did you actually have any DNA, or were you just trying to flush him out by using the magic words DNA?
No. I mean,
it doesn't actually say we have the DNA, does it?
No, I didn't personally have any DNA, but what I'd identified from my informants, police informants and things, was that a description of the murder weapon, the pickaxe handle, quite clearly said that it had, they'd identified a third blood sample, hairs and fibres, and I think there's a palm print on the murder weapon. Now, they didn't belong to Stephen Downing, so they weren't introduced as evidence, you see, because there was no connection to him.
And like with a lot of aspects of the forensics, and when I was looking through them, and indeed some of the submission, it's not so much about proving exactly someone else didn't do it or that Stephen definitely didn't, but it's about doubt.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
and I mean, saying that actually, if there was someone else here, or there possibly was here, it isn't the clear-cut conviction that the jury was, or the evidence that they were presented with, and that that led directly to Stephen and only to Stephen.
Well, there were so many boxes that came up that were, it really flagged up as red boxes to me, because there were massive question marks over them. But like I say, with this one, with potential forensic and stuff, where nothing had been qualified, nothing had been really followed through properly, because it didn't link to Downing, but it may have linked to somebody else. And I mean, the whole of the scene of crime was a complete mishmash.
And because the crime scene was such a mess, the new magic bullet forensic technique would have been no use anyway.
In 1973, they had no concept of the contamination issues that DNA was going to bring.
Forensic expert John Wright, ex-Met Police, and currently lecturer at Derby University.
When I first started work, we worked in open laboratories. Although we worked in separate areas, the laboratory was actually open. There were air channels between laboratories. Now you work in sealed laboratories because you are trying to ensure that nothing from a suspect can transfer to a victim's clothing accidentally or anything else. Contamination is a major issue, and we have to look at what we call the chain of custody. So we look at everything has to be signed for, documented where it's been, what's happened to it, and also we have to avoid contamination. So everything's examined in different areas, different benches, different sets of equipment and everything else.
Because that seems something that, you know, reading reports of the initial attack, that A, people were trying to, you know, look after Wendy, but also that people were trying to mark the crime scene didn't have any kind of knowledge of keeping things separate and cross-contamination, even to the point where clothes and weapons were put in the same bag to be taken away.
Well, that's... If a police officer had had half a day's forensic training, they'd have been lucky. Mm. So they may not have been forensically aware. They may have thought they were doing the right thing and gathering it up and putting it together, whereas now, hopefully, they'd be aware of it and they keep stuff separate. This is why cold cases are so difficult, because we might have these lovely new techniques, but if the evidence isn't stored correctly, then we can't use it.
So in terms of forensic science, can you tell me the kind of changes in forensic science from the kind of early 70s to now? I mean, the case we're looking at happened in 1973.
Forensic science is an ever-changing science. Predominantly, I suppose, it's sort of biology and biochemistry based, but it takes science from all over the place. And if a good technique becomes available, then it gets quite often adopted into forensic science. The main change, perhaps, from that time is that in 1973, we were doing what's called blood grouping, where we could tell whether somebody was an A, an O, but we couldn't actually differentiate blood samples from one person to another. We could narrow them down to a group, but we couldn't actually get the blood samples to one person. Fingerprints have been in existence since the 1900s and were very well established evidence.
When did DNA come in?
It was actually developed, the technique was developed initially for immigration type cases, just looking for parentage, because it's really good. That's what it's really good at. You can, if you have a full DNA profile of mother, father and child, you can actually see where that child has got their inherited genes from, because you inherit half your DNA from your mum, half from your dad.
One result of the media attention was the emergence of new witnesses and new evidence.
I think it was in response to the TV documentary that didn't someone from Derby Museum ring up and go, we've got the murder weapon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a strange thing. I mean, so the animosity and denials from Derbyshire Police about, you know, everything's been burnt, lost and destroyed. What can we do because we've got nothing to go on now and all this sort of business.
You kept going to them, can I see this? Can I see this evidence? Can I see this? And they go, no.
Yeah.
It's
you
been
know, we
burnt.
Would we would consider helping you, but we've got nothing and, you know, where do we go from here? It's all down to you, basically, but he's as guilty as hell and, you know...
All the evidence has been burnt, lost and destroyed.
Yeah. So suddenly, you know, I did my own publicity and stuff like this, and this guy came up with real Derbyshire accent, you know, from Derby Museum, saying he's an assistant curator at the Derby Police Museum. I gather you're looking for the murder weapon. And I said, yeah, you mean the pickaxe handle? He said, yeah. I said, well, it's been burnt, lost and destroyed. That's probably been burnt. He says, hasn't, mate. He says, it's here. It's our prime exhibit. It's on display in the museum, and it's got a brass thing with it, you know, one of Derbyshire Police's quickest convictions type thing. You know, gives the date and Wendy Sewell murder, you know, September 73 and all the rest.
Yep.
He said, do you want to come around and pick it up?
Right, we're in the Rutland Hotel in the centre of the town, at Market Town of Bakewell in North Derbyshire. My name's David G. I was a member of the Derbyshire Police for just over 30 years. We were lucky that we'd still got the murder weapon, the pickaxe handle, effectively.
Wasn't that found in the museum?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah. It was in the museum. We found it. No, I can say no more than that. We found it in our search, extensive search. We found it.
The murder weapon was a pickaxe stave. So the pickaxe stave was...
That's a handle.
Sorry, the pickaxe handle. Yeah. Yes, I beg your pardon. Very. Yeah.
I'm using
my hands to show it. And it doesn't really work on radio, does it? Or on audio. So my name is Tony Blockley. When I retired, I was the chief superintendent or the head of crime. So I had responsibility for all crime in and around Derbyshire. So yes, it was a pickaxe handle without the head on it. It was kept in what they called the consecrated chapel, which was a workman's. It had been deconsecrated, so it was no longer a religious aspect, but it was in the graveyard. Stephen said at a point in time, yes, he had been using that during the day because they used it for all sorts of different things, but at that time he hadn't been. And there was it was thought to be lost. And in actual fact, it wasn't lost. It was found, and it was found in a museum. At that time, we had a museum, a police museum, and it was within the police museum.
And in Derby?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Right. That's right, because it's in the book, isn't it? This is rather extraordinary.
Yes.
Phone call. About...
Yes. Yeah. I know. So we actually recovered the stave, the handle. And, you know, forensically, I mean, even today, you know, if you were investigating it today and... a person's, you know, if Stephen's DNA was on it, well, he's already said he's been picked it up. It's what they call a transferable item. So it doesn't have any evidential validity. You know, yes, it was that, but actually anybody could have used it.
At the same time as he was courting UK press and broadcasting, Don and his legal team were also pursuing a case in the European courts, a case against the UK government. It was an attempt to overturn the IDOM legislation as a breach of EU human rights laws.
You know, the publicity was certainly helping with all this. And what also helped as well is that the Midlands video won a national award, you know, because of the content and whatever. And so the BBC agreed to re-show this on BBC Two, and it was shown as it was in the same form. And again, it attracted a massive amount of interest and publicity. But it also brought on board... a lot of the national and international press, really. And so it all helped to generate publicity. And again, at the same time, we were coming to conclusions on the European part. So, you know, we were winning cases against the government. And the strange thing was then I started to get an awful lot of interest from countries that absolutely hated Britain because I was seen as a crusader against the British government. I was taking on the British government on... two or three fronts here, and calling them out, you see.
But the resurgence of interest in the murder would take its toll in the small town of Bakewell. And Wendy, or rather Wendy's memory, took the brunt of it. Was she really considered nothing more than collateral damage?
I do want to talk about the Bakewell Tart issue. Which paper was that?
The Mail Group, really. Mail. Right.
So when the Nationals got hold of it and...
The Mail and Sunday, Daily Mail, initially, and all those... picked it up later on to run with the same tag, but they called the victim the Bakewell Tart, and they painted a
Wendy Sewell.
Yeah, they painted the victim pretty awful at times.
Yeah, the headlines are shocking, aren't they?
The Mail sort of ran with this and seemed to love playing on this.
Unfortunately, the headline "The Bakewell Tart" is too good a headline for journalists to miss, and it was also unkind on Wendy herself.
Times columnist Matthew Paris,
but. What grabs the press, and it did at least keep the story, if not lively, still kind of alive, and that will have helped Don in a way in his efforts to get the whole thing reopened.
They say bad news travels, and this headline certainly did. Don received this letter from Wendy's cousin in Canada.
Dear Mr. Hale, Wendy Sewell was my cousin. I did not know of your campaign over so many years. I very much admire your tenacity. I also have tremendous admiration for Stephen's mother father and sister, for the continued faith they showed in their son and brother. No one can take away the hurt and pain that Stephen and his family have suffered. No amount of compensation will change that. No words from a Prime Minister or even a Queen will erase the horrors Stephen has gone through or give him back his life. I expect that knowing people like you are supporting him for so many years and perhaps hopefully seeing the real culprits brought to justice will provide some measure of comfort. At the time of Wendy's death, I just accepted what we were told, not knowing the background to the case. I was fortunate to have had a couple of pints with Wendy not long before she was killed. I know we would have continued to be good friends had she lived.
God, it's heartbreaking, isn't it?
It really is heartbreaking. Wendy has no brothers or sisters to defend her. It really saddened and angered me to read through the articles and find no words of sympathy, solace or remembrance for another victim of this tragedy, the main one, Wendy Sewell, who was beaten to death. The memory I have of Wendy Sewell is of a young, fun-loving cousin. She was my mum's brother's daughter and her parents loved her and were proud of her, just the same as Stephen's parents. My anger is raised when I read the Bakewell tart, numerous affairs and blackmail. Even if she was the person Bakewell wishes to betray her as, she did not deserve to be beaten to death. To lie waiting for an ambulance for 40 minutes and to have those responsible free for all this time. She could have been saved. My anger is directed at those who have known for so many years who was responsible and said nothing. How can they sleep peacefully? I am sure that at the time of the murder, there were several of Bakewell's good citizens saying, "Oh God, she got what she deserved." No, she did not. No one deserves to be beaten to death or to be called a Bakewell tart, etc. Come on, Bakewell, where is your North Country kindness and generosity? Maybe if some of the brave men of Bakewell had kept their belts done up, this tragedy would never have happened. Yours sincerely, Malcolm Bainan.
With new evidence and new interest, Don feels that momentum in the case is definitely building.
So I phoned up John Atkins, his lawyer, and he couldn't believe it. And John was saying, well, what do we actually need to move on? I said, well, we've got to get a forensic expert, we've got to get a photographer, we've got to get a police expert, etc., etc. And we applied and successfully got legal aid funding, £13,000 or whatever it was for these. So we brought these experts on board. The police went absolutely ballistic because these were police experts that they used themselves. So you can't use them and can't use them. Well, you know, you're using them as police experts. They're independent people. We'll use who the hell we want, you know, get lost. And so we used these and they came out and absolutely crucified everything the police had done on the case. And they got the murder weapon now, which we had forensically tested. And they found got the original documents from that didn't exist, you know.
Now you had all the bits of that jigsaw puzzle in the playground.
That's it. Yeah.
The difference between a Bakewell pudding and a Bakewell tart. The Bakewell tart is shortcrust pastry, jam and a layer of almond sponge, which most people know. You can buy them anywhere in the country.
Can you tell me who you are and where we are?
My name's Moira Black and I work in Bloomers at Bakewell, one of the pudding shops. The Bakewell pudding you can only buy in Bakewell and it's puff pastry with a layer of jam and the topping is butter, sugar, eggs and ground almonds. It's more of a dessert that you'd serve warm with cream or ice cream, whatever takes your fancy. But how it came into being, instead of putting flour into the pudding, the cook at the Rutland put ground almonds. And the owner liked it so much, he called it the pudding.
Was it a mistake? Was it a
mistake? It was a happy accident. But it is only made in Bakewell.
Ah. So are you from Bakewell originally?
No, I'm from Sheffield originally.
Are you?
Yeah.
Ah. Okay, let me ask you something totally off the wall then. I am investigating, I'm making a series of programmes
right.
about the case about Wendy Sewell being murdered.
Oh, right, yeah.
Do you remember that, or do you remember the reinvestigation?
I remember it all, yeah. I remember when it happened, and I remember the editor of the Mercury, Don Hale, investigating the case. It took him, I think, 7 or 8 years, and apparently there's another book coming out
yes.
by Don Hale. Which I've got on pre-order.
Have you?
I don't believe it was Stephen Downing. And there's lots of rumours, which I can't say whether they're right or wrong. But I think there was a lot of cover-ups. I'm convinced there was a lot of cover-ups. But, you know, Stephen Downing still gets blamed for it in Bakewell. Really? The town without pity.
Do you think, because that's really harsh title, isn't it? But do you think it's
true? I think it's very true. I think it's very true about the people in Bakewell, you see. Yeah. So, but they still believe it was him.
So you remember when it happened, the attack happened?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's horrific.
And you think about this as such a picture post.
I know. You don't believe anything like this can happen. No, but, no. As I said, there's lots of rumours go around. I personally don't believe it was Stephen.
What are the rumours?
Well, I'm not prepared to say what the rumours are.
Can you remember when he came back in the mid-90s? He came for a visit from prison.
I don't remember that, him coming for the day. I don't remember. But the town welcomed him then. But, you know, it's a very bad time. A terrible murder. I mean, awful. Awful thing to have happened. I think it's very unfair. I mean, the way she was talked about. As well. I mean, we none of us know what she was really like, so I think it was terrible the way she was talked about.
Yeah.
You know.
The other side effect of the campaign protesting Stephen's innocence was the accusations of guilt flying around Bakewell. If Stephen Downing hadn't killed Wendy Sewell, somebody else had. Somebody else that's still out there. Despite their solid alibis, accusations, as usual, were first pointed at those closest to the victim. Wendy's husband, David, her former boyfriend, John Marshall, and her alleged lover, Mr. Red.
When Stephen was taken in for questioning from about sort of 1:30, 2:00 on the day of the attack, he was taken in for questioning then. Within hours, David Sewell, the husband, was also taken in for questioning as a suspect and was told he was a potential suspect, as was the alleged boyfriend at the time, Mr. Red. He was also... So you got three people in the cells at the same time, all being questioned over the attack. You know, so you got the husband, a boyfriend, and Stephen as the potential suspects. Now, Stephen wasn't told he was a suspect where the other two were. Now, you know, that is strange in itself, really. If there's a robbery normally, or some major incident, say a big burglary, whatever, then the police will bring in the usual suspects. They will line up three or four people that have been in trouble before, just come out of prison or whatever. And so it was the police then, you know, it's not me saying that, this is fact, that these people were brought in. And of course, David Sewell was not happy about the fact he was brought in for questioning and was a potential suspect.
But you're saying, I don't think we've talked about this, is that the police already had Stephen in their sights.
Well, Ernie Charlesworth was the local beat Bobby, you know, a beefy sort of guy. He was the font of all knowledge from as far as the, you know, the local Bobbies were concerned. He thought he was God's gift as a policeman. And he would go around and give kids a clip round the ear sort of thing to keep them out of trouble.
Sounds like a bit of a bully.
Yeah, he was. He was a mini thug type bully who thought he could do what he wanted. He got a free range. He ran that area. And he was the man that you saw really when he went in the police station. Or he was the man that, you know, was put in front of you if you made any complaint or you got anything to argue with. And we found with this case in particular, his name cropped up so many, many times that once I got involved with the investigation, so many people said that they'd been down to the police station and they'd seen Ernie, and he said, you're basically wasting your time, he's already admitted it. We've got the man that's done it, that's it. And he was the man that was seemed to be continually saying that... making false allegations about Stephen.
Charlesworth, yeah.
Yeah. You know, oh, yeah, we've been watching him for years. He
he'd been up to different things. There was an assault on a woman, you know, a few years before when I think he was probably about 14 or something like that. You know, there was all sorts of things that didn't stand up really. But it was the impression he was giving to fellow officers and the impression given to Joe Public that Stephen had got was a bit of an oddball and a bit, you know, potentially a pervert.
But why were these accusations being made about Stephen? And why did so many townspeople seem prepared to accept that he was capable of a brutal attack on a woman? As if it wasn't a surprise. Why was this pervert label being flung around? Some were saying that the attack on Wendy was an accident waiting to happen. Well, hardly an accident. But could people, should people have seen it coming? Could it have been prevented? And if so, would Wendy still be alive?
If he is eventually released with a pardon, Danny will be the longest-serving wrongly convicted prisoner in history and could eventually receive over £1 million in compensation.
Who is the real Stephen Downing? And what is the reality of growing up inside the prison system? Join us to hear Stephen Downing, in his own words, in Episode 7 of Murder in the Graveyard. And you can delve deeper into the podcast by visiting our website, reporterpodcast.com. And please feel free to rate and review the series. Reporter Murder in the Graveyard is presented and produced by me, Lucy Ditchmont. It's mixed by Dave Dodd. The music is composed and performed by Edwin Pearson. The executive producer is Matt Hall. And Reporter Murder in the Graveyard is a Wireless Studios production.
William Tyrrell was a three-year-old boy who disappeared from the township of Kendal on the New South Wales mid-north coast on 12 September 2014. Police have been told he was outside playing one minute and gone the next. His disappearance has become one of the most puzzling investigations in Australian history. It has been going on now for almost 5 years. Millions of dollars have been spent. The strike force at one point had 26 full-time detectives. Hundreds more around Australia have been exploring 600 possible suspects. And what has all that been for? William is still missing. My name is Caroline Overington. This investigation, Nowhere Child, is available now. To hear more, just search for Nowhere Child in your podcast app.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.